The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Disease of the stomach is presented by Dr. Jack Bragg.
Thanks, Gail. Good afternoon, fellow osteopathic internists. My task for the next 30 minutes is to talk about diseases of the stomach. It's not obviously in 30 minutes going to be an exhaustive lecture, but we'll cover as much ground as we can and try to cover, you know, board questions are composed for the most part of stuff you never see clinically. So we're going to talk about some of the odd and unusual type of diseases in all of these categories to try to give you a little bit of a heads up on what you may see when it comes time to take the board exams. So the first five or six slides here just tell you the topics that we're going to look at: neuromuscular disorders, gastritis and gastropathies, peptic ulcer disease, upper GI bleeding, some of the granulomatous gastritides, some of the distinctive gastritides that you see there, and some miscellaneous forms of gastritis, and lastly, carcinoid tumors in AMAG, and I'll tell you what AMAG here is in a few minutes. So let's start with diabetic gastroparesis. You can have a motility disorder of the, anywhere in the GI tract, but the stomach, that's caused by either a neuropathy or a myopathy, and we've all had patients who were either taking tricyclics or narcotics that slowed down function of the entire GI tract, including the stomach. And then there's a few undefined type of maladies that affect the stomach. Probably the most common ones are what you see there at the bottom of the slide. Non-ulcer dyspepsia and irritable bowel syndrome can affect the stomach. They affect the small bowel and the colon more, but you'll see people with epigastric pain that have a normal EGD, normal ultrasound, normal lab work, normal every kind of test you can imagine, and they still have epigastric pain. Usually those folks have non-ulcer dyspepsia. Sometimes it responds to PPIs, and most of the time it does not. Accelerated and delayed gastric emptying usually cannot be distinguished one from the other based on the symptoms, because as you can see on the slide, many of the symptoms are similar between the two abnormalities. So we'll look at how to distinguish the two. Diabetes affects basically everything from head to toe. And in the GI tract, it affects everything from the mouth to the anus. In this case, we're looking at gastroparesis, usually presents with nausea, vomiting, postprandial fullness, and abdominal pain, occasionally bleeding, but that's unusual. Gastroparesis is very common. It can occur in either type 1 or type 2 diabetes. 50% of all type 1 patients have it. We used to say it was axiomatic that you had to have diabetes for 10 years before you developed gastroparesis. We don't say that anymore, primarily because it's not necessarily true. It may be common, but you don't have to have had diabetes 10 years to develop gastroparesis. It tends to be associated with an autonomic neuropathy that goes along with diabetes, although that's probably not the whole story. There's more than likely other factors involved. High blood sugars can exacerbate the gastropathy or the gastroparesis, so good blood sugar control is important in treating this. And the consequences you can see there may be delayed emptying of solids, rapid emptying of liquids, bezoar formation, poor blood sugar control, a vicious cycle, and if it's severe, malnutrition and weight loss. So, how do you diagnose gastroparesis? Well, most of the time, patients are going to have an EGD. That's not to diagnose gastroparesis, it's to make sure there's not something else there, like a bezoar or like peptic ulcer disease or a gastric outlet obstruction from one of several different causes. But the diagnosis is done mainly with a nuclear test called a gastric emptying study. Most of the time you're going to order a solid phase gastric emptying study. And I'll show you what a definition of an abnormal one is here. But with as far as dumping syndrome goes, it occurs in patients after a vagotomy and pyloroplasty, usually because you've altered the anatomy of the stomach and you get rapid emptying of food into the duodenum. Symptoms during the first hour, you can see there, pain, bloating, nausea, vomiting. 2 to 4 hours later, sweating, lightheadedness, cramps, and diarrhea. That all occurs because of rapid absorption of carbohydrates. Definition of rapid gastric emptying, when more than 30% of the meal, and I'm talking about the solid phase gastric emptying study, when more than 30% of it leaves the stomach within 30 minutes or more than 70% at 60 minutes, you have by definition rapid gastric emptying. So what are the causes of this other than the surgery I just mentioned, the pyloroplasty and the vagotomy? You can have idiopathic rapid gastric emptying. You don't see that a lot, it's unusual, but if they don't have diabetes, they've not had surgery, they're not on drugs of any kind that would cause that, it may well be idiopathic. Early diabetes type 2, early on, they may have rapid gastric emptying before they have had time to develop gastroparesis. Zollinger-Ellison syndrome that we'll look at, and the surgeries we've already covered, any of those things can cause rapid gastric emptying. Gastropathy and gastritis, and these, probably nobody has ever picked up a pathology report and left without some confusion regarding the terminology that the pathologist may use when they're describing histologically what they're seeing under the microscope. But these are generally accepted definitions of some of the terms they use. A gastropathy is virtually, other than malignancy, any gastric lesion that does not have inflammatory cells. No neutrophils, no mononuclear type of cells, just an abnormal gastric biopsy. A gastritis, on the other hand, does contain leukocyte infiltration. Usually if it's active and acute, they're gonna be neutrophils. Chronic gastritis includes mononuclear leukocytes, and chronic active gastritis includes mixed chronic and active inflammation. So it's old and it's new both in that particular patient. There's a lot of other terminology as far as gastritis goes that you'll see. Those are the standard definitions. Atrophic gastritis, fairly typical in patients who are over 60. That's usually the group of folks that you'll see with atrophic gastritis. As you can see there's two types. There's the autoimmune and the environmental. Probably for board exams, the type A or the autoimmune is the one I would know the best because it's less common than the environmental or type B, and it makes good board material because you have some interesting phenomenon going on with autoimmune gastritis, atrophic gastritis. You have parietal cell antibodies. You can develop pernicious anemia because of lack of absorption of B12 and intrinsic factor. Serum gastrin level is oftentimes high, so you have to distinguish between it and a gastrinoma. Hydrochloric acid secretion is absent or very low. Gastric ulcer is rare. Gastric cancer may be a risk factor for gastric cancer. It may be more of an association really rather than a cause. The environmental type is usually associated with H. pylori or a couple of other things that I may have a slide that details some of that. So this is what it looks like. This is a cartoon of what endoscopically what you might see if you're scoping somebody that has autoimmune or environmental atrophic gastritis. Where you see the orange areas there is usually where you see the pathology in these two types of diseases. Granulomatous gastritis. You can have granulomas in the stomach from some of the systemic diseases we see, such as Crohn's, sarcoidosis, or Wegener's granulomatosis. You can have granulomas that are in the stomach that are not part of a systemic process, such as isolated granulomatous gastritis. Foreign material. I've seen a toothpick lodged in gastric mucosa. Occasionally you will see something like a coin that was not able to get out of the stomach and pass on that causes a granulomatous type of response, or a Ewald lymphoma that we'll talk more about that presents with granulomas in the stomach. Some of the infections that may cause granulomas include H. pylori, TB, tertiary syphilis, Whipple's disease, and histoplasmosis. All may give you granulomas in the stomach. Lymphocytic gastritis, a very unusual phenomenon. I don't remember the last time I saw a case of it. Variola-form gastritis is just the way lymphocytic gastritis looks, but you can see lymphocytic gastritis, in other words, lymphocytes, increased lymphocytes in the gastric mucosa that the pathologist sees. You may see that with celiac disease, H. pylori, hypertrophic lymphocytic gastritis, usually with the large gastric folds that we'll look at, ticlodipine, lymphocytic colitis, or collagenous colitis, we'll talk about in another lecture. Any of those can present with lymphocytic gastritis. Large gastric folds, not too unusual to show you a picture of a upper endoscopy in a stomach, and the folds are obviously much larger than what the normal rugae are, and you may be given a few other clinical details and asked, what's the diagnosis in this case? Well, this is your list of possibilities. Gastrin-stimulated rugal hypertrophy, you see in ZE, Zollinger-Ellison, and some duodenal ulcer patients. Hypertrophic hypersecretory gastropathy, not gastrin-stimulated. You see that with a protein-losing gastropathy from time to time. Menetrier's disease, I'll show you a picture of that. And you see some miscellaneous causes there of large gastric folds. On the left is a case of amyloidosis. Histology is on the right. A good point to keep in mind is when you want to rule out amyloid, whether it's here or someplace else in the GI tract, you need to ask the pathologist to do a Congo red study, because unless they think you're looking for amyloid, they won't do it. So you have to ask for a Congo red stain on some of your slides to check for amyloid. On the left is a resected stomach from a patient with Zollinger-Ellison. You can see where the antrum is, and you can see that an antrum usually is smooth. An antrum hardly ever has folds, but this entire stomach is taken up with large folds, as you can see. On the right is a case of Menetrier's, and basically the same thing. There's no smooth antrum. The entire stomach's taken up with very large gastric folds. That's what it looks like. Non-ulcer dyspepsia, I talked about that a minute ago. H. pylori frequency is about the same as in the asymptomatic population. There was a lot of press a few years ago about people with non-ulcer dyspepsia and H. pylori eradicating the infection, and the non-ulcer dyspepsia might go away. Well, sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. Prospective clinical trials of anti-H. pylori therapy have been disappointing in treating non-ulcer dyspepsia, to say the least. And as yet, we're unable to identify a subpopulation that achieves long-term symptomatic benefit from H. pylori. So what they would say is do an antibody test for H. pylori that we'll look at. If it's positive, treat them without doing an endoscopy. And some of your NUD patients may get better, but a lot of them didn't. Peptic ulcer disease, two most common causes still today, H. pylori infection and non-steroidal use. Keep in mind these rare causes. Again, they make great board questions. Pathologic hypersecretory states that we just looked at, herpes simplex, Crohn's disease, systemic mastocytosis can all cause peptic ulcer disease, but non-steroidals and H. pylori are the most common. There's a group of folks that have peptic ulcer disease and have none of those characteristics. Nobody is quite sure yet why they have peptic ulcer disease if they don't have any of those things, so there's more to the story yet that we don't know. Ulcers caused by non-acid peptic disorders on the right, carcinoma, Kaposi's syndrome, or Kaposi's tumor, lymphoma, pancreatic rest, syphilis, candida infection, And down at the bottom in the duodenum, Crohn's disease and pancreatic carcinoma can all present with peptic ulcer disease without H. pylori or a history of non-steroidal use. Gastric cancers may ulcerate and resemble gastric ulcers. Now, the reason this is on here is because there's a different lecture for GI oncology, but a very important point that may come up is your patient with a gastric ulcer has been treated successfully with either withdrawal of the non-steroidals or a treatment of H. pylori. They come in to see you in 6 to 8 weeks in the office, and they're still having the same abdominal pain. What's going on? It's critical in a patient with a gastric ulcer, but not a duodenal ulcer, but a gastric ulcer, that you re-endoscope them in 8 weeks and make sure that what you thought was a gastric ulcer is not a gastric malignancy. That doesn't happen with duodenal ulcers. You don't have to re-scope them. You just treat them. They almost always get better. But a patient with a gastric ulcer should have a repeat upper endoscopy 8 weeks after you've diagnosed it and treated it, because a small number of them, especially in people over the age of 60, will have a gastric cancer rather than just a benign gastric ulcer. A little more on H. pylori. This is what it looks like. The flagella you can see there, it's gram negative, it's a spiral rod, it's fastidious, microaerophilic. Urease positive and has a unipolar flagella that you just saw. Pathophysiology of this organism is that it's ingested orally. You may recall Barry Marshall and his colleague intentionally swallowing H. pylori to try and prove that it did cause an infection and peptic ulcer disease. The H. pylori swims, if you will, through the mucosa or through the mucus to the epithelial layer. It attaches to the mucosa, begins to elaborate ammonia, which destroys the mucus layer and opens it up for an attack of a very low pH stomach contents, and that results in ulcer either in the stomach, or if you have gastric metaplasia to the duodenal bulb, you may get your ulcer in the duodenum. It multiplies, damages tissues. I don't know of any evidence that it internalizes it. You've never seen anybody with H. pylori sepsis. You've never seen anybody with an H. pylori abscess. It just doesn't happen because the bug most likely stays completely in the stomach. What's the outcome of H. pylori? Here's your possibilities right here. Everything from asymptomatic infection all the way to gastric malt lymphoma and several things in between. We've talked about peptic ulcer disease and carcinoma. We'll look at some of those others as well. Alterations in the duodenal structure and function as a result of H. pylori infection include damage to surface cells, as we mentioned, increase in proportion of surface covered by gastric metaplasia, gastric cells that are still producing acid, some with the ability to secrete enough acid to cause a duodenal bulb ulcer. You end up with a scarred, deformed, smaller bulb and abnormal bicarb secretion as a result of that. So, diagnosis, in addition to endoscopy, and as you see there under the invasive category, rapid urease tests from a biopsy in the stomach is a quick way to diagnose it, but we also have antibody tests, urea breath tests, and a stool antigen. Nobody does cultures other than for research purposes, and histology is still done quite a bit for this. The antibody tests, the one that's available is an IgG antibody, and occasionally my GI fellows will still order an IgG antibody for H. pylori under certain circumstances. And so when I ask them, well, what are you going to learn from that? And the response usually is, well, whether or not the patient has an H. pylori infection. I say, how are you going to distinguish that between acute and prior infection? And usually I've got them right there because they don't know. But that's the problem with this antibody test. If it's positive, you don't know if you're dealing with an active infection or one that occurred several years ago, because it takes a long time for that antibody level to eventually normalize. It's used sometimes in follow-up if you treat a patient for H. pylori infection, and then you want to know 8 or 12 weeks down the line, did I eradicate the infection? And you can do it under those circumstances, but your patient has to be off the PPI for 2 to 4 weeks, and it's kind of a hassle to do. They may not want to stop the medicine. So it's not the best test for, the antibody test isn't the best test for follow-up either. One of the other tests that I mentioned, like the breath test, the urea breath test, is a good test to do. One's radioactive and one's not. This test is very sensitive and specific, and it will tell you for sure whether you have eradicated the infection or not. Stool antigen is good too. It's a very sensitive and specific test, and we probably use more of that than anything else. If it was a duodenal ulcer and their symptoms are gone, you do not need to re-scope them and do another biopsy to see if the infection is still there or if it's eradicated. A breath test or stool antigen is quite sufficient for determining that. World Health Organization has declared H. pylori as a group 1 or a definite carcinogen. We know that. It is also responsible for some of the cases of MALT lymphoma that we see in the stomach. MALT stands for mucosa-associated lymphoid tissue, which in and of itself is benign, but if you add a monoclonal proliferation of neoplastic B lymphocytes, then you have a MALT lymphoma. It may be asymptomatic, or your patient may have minor symptoms such as dyspepsia. They could have weight loss. They could have peptic ulcer disease. Mucosa may appear normal on endoscopy. They may have thickened folds, or they may have ulcerations. So almost anything is within the realm of possibility, at least early on with a gastric MALT lymphoma. In a patient who is over the age of 60, if they have significant symptoms and you do an endoscopy and you don't see anything, it's probably wise to go ahead and do just some random biopsies just to make sure you're not dealing with this particular malady. With the MALT lymphoma, cure of the H. pylori infection results in remission about 75% of the time. It's not a cure-all, obviously. Regression usually occurs within 6 months, but might take longer. And if the patient gets recurrent infection from H. pylori, they may have the MALT lymphoma come back. Most of you are familiar with the drugs. This list hasn't changed a lot over the last few years. There are several FDA-approved treatments for H. pylori, but most of them consist of this group of medicines here. Here's one of them. And the others are very similar. There's now salvage therapy. There's several different things you can do. If your patient's been treated once or twice, you weren't able to eradicate the infection, there's a whole different path you can go down as far as treating to try to eradicate the bug. Diagram of the parietal cell. This is just as a reminder that over here on the vascular side of the parietal cell, you have all of these receptors for the various types of molecules floating around in the bloodstream. The only one of those that you can block and significantly reduce gastric acid production is the histamine receptor. When cimetidine was marketed in 1977, it quickly replaced Valium as the number one selling drug in the United States. Now there's a dozen H2 blockers. They're over the counter, and they're still used a great deal. The way PPIs work, though, is they don't obstruct any of the receptors, but they destroy the hydrogen-potassium pump that exchanges potassium for hydrogen. And with that, you get about 98% reduction in the secretion of stomach acid. So the PPIs are much more potent, much better drugs, as good as we thought the H2 blockers were. Non-steroidal ulcers, obviously, the history's clue here. Now, some people don't consider aspirin or Tylenol as medicine. So you have to ask specifically, do you take aspirin? Even an 81 milligram baby aspirin has the potential to cause peptic ulcer disease. Non-steroidal ulcers generally are on the greater curve. They are usually in the stomach. Occasionally you will see one in the duodenum, but not that often. They may present with GI bleeding, pain, vomiting, gastric outlet obstruction. They may or may not be negative for H. pylori. What do you do if you have a patient with a non-steroidal ulcer and H. pylori? Well, you treat them both because the effect is probably additive. They have a higher risk of a peptic ulcer disease if they have both. They may be difficult to heal, and that's not because of anything that's intrinsically different because of a non-steroidal drug, but most patients that take a non-steroidal are taking it for bad joints, for arthritis, and they don't want to give it up. And if you know that, you can try to treat around it, continue to treat the ulcer and continue their non-steroidal. It may drag out the healing process, and they may have complications from it. The ulcer may not heal. But you can try to do that if they really need the non-steroidal drug. It's better to stop it and try to heal up the ulcer before they use anything else for their arthritis. Upper GI bleeding. Therapeutic endoscopy. When we scope somebody who has an upper GI bleed, we can gain initial control most of the time, 80% of the time. A few of those don't re-bleed. We usually try to repeat endoscopic therapy at least one more time, sometimes twice more, trying to get permanent control. If not, patients looking at either angiography, if you have an interventional radiologist in your institution, or if you don't, then surgery in order to stop the bleeding. Adverse clinical prognostic factors in a GI bleeder: shock, obviously, that means they've lost a lot of blood. If they're vomiting red blood rather than old coffee ground emesis, if they're bleeding from esophageal varices or esophageal or gastric cancer, that's really bad news. Comorbid disease like renal failure, coronary artery disease, congestive heart failure, all of those add to the morbidity. Older age, obviously, the older folks oftentimes don't do as well with strenuous or stressful diseases like this. If the bleeding occurs while the patient's in the hospital for something else, that's a bad prognostic factor. That means they're really sick if they're sick enough to have not only what they came in with, but GI bleeding as well. And recurrent bleeding is always bad because that means it's going to be a difficult process to control. Units of packed red cells transfused. This is just common sense. The more red blood cells they've had to have transfused, the worse their prognosis and the higher their mortality. These diagnoses down at the bottom show you what is most likely to re-bleed and which is most likely to claim a patient's life. Varices and cancer, they have underlying problems in addition to GI bleeding, and they're very sick to start with, so it's not surprising they don't do well. Peptic ulcer disease follows gastric erosions, Mallory Weiss, and no diagnosis. Now you may wonder, if you're not a gastroenterologist, how many gastroenterologists are here? I know Pete Walsh is here. Is anybody else a gastroenterologist? One? You ask, how can you have an upper GI bleed and no diagnosis? But, and I don't know why, but the longer you wait to do the endoscopy, the more likely you are to have a no diagnosis. And whether that means the patient had a Dufoy's lesion or some small bleeder that has healed up in the time they bled and the time you scope them, I don't know, but it is possible to have somebody vomit blood, and if the EGD takes long enough to do, there may be no diagnosis. You may not find anything. So it does happen. It doesn't seem to make sense, but it does happen. Keep in mind the folks who need prophylaxis against stress ulcers, ventilator-dependent patients longer than 48 hours, people with a coagulopathy, burns over 30% of the body or more, and head injuries, neurological patients, they should all be prophylaxed. These are some very unusual types of upper GI bleeding that occur either solely in the gut or gut and skin problems. You could be shown a picture of somebody with blue rubber bleb nevus syndrome and who is throwing up blood. Well, you're asked, what's the cause? Well, it's a vascular abnormality. This breaks down into what causes upper GI bleeding. You can see duodenal ulcer and gastric ulcer, far and away the most common. Gastric erosions right behind. Here's some of the rare causes I would keep in the back of my head that may show up on board exams. that can cause upper GI bleeding. Usually the history is important here as well as what you see on endoscopy. Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, remember, there's two triads with this that you need to remember. The first one's in the box there, gastric acid hypersecretion, severe peptic ulcer disease, and non-beta islet cell tumors of the pancreas. The last triad is the very bottom bullet. 1/4 have multiple endocrine neoplasia syndrome, MEN1, and tumors of the parathyroid, pituitary, and pancreatic islets, 3 Ps, parathyroid, pituitary, and pancreatic. ZE patients have some features that duodenal ulcer and gastric ulcer patients by themselves do not have. You can see the list here. They're more likely to have diarrhea. They're more likely to have ulcers in other places like esophagus than just the run-of-the-mill ulcer patient. Last thing I think on the list is gastric carcinoids. On the left is what it looks like endoscopically. On the right, in the middle and the right, you see some of the histology. There are 3 different varieties. The top one there is the most common. 60-80% of patients have a carcinoid associated with AMAG, autoimmune metaplastic atrophic gastritis, and a declining proportion with the other 2 diagnoses. I think that's the last one.